After clearing Snug Bay, I hauled the sloop to the wind, repaired the windlass, and hove the anchor to the hawse, and then stretched across to a port of refuge under a high mountain about 6 miles away, and came into 9 fathoms, close under the face of a perpendicular cliff. Here my own voice answered back, and I named the place Echo Mountain. Seeing dead trees farther along where the shore was broken, I made a landing for fuel, taking, besides my axe, a rifle, which on these days I never left far from hand. But I saw no living thing here except a small spider, which had nested in a dry log. The conduct of this insect interested me now more than anything else around the wild place. In my cabin, it met, oddly enough, a spider of its own size and species that had come all the way from Boston. A very civil little chap, too, but mighty spry. Well, the Fuegian threw up its antenna for a fight, but my little Bostonian downed it at once, so dexterously that in less than 3 minutes from the time the battle began, the Fuegian spider didn't know itself from a fly. I made haste the following morning to be underway after a night of wakefulness on the weird shore. Before weighing anchor, however, I prepared a cup of warm coffee over a smart wood fire in my great Montevideo stove. In the same fire was cremated the Fuegian spider, slain the day before by the little warrior from Boston. The spray now reached away for Coffee Island, which I sighted on my birthday, February 20th, 1896. There she encountered another gale that brought her in the lee of Great Charles Island for shelter. On a bluff point on Charles were signal fires, and a tribe of savages mustered here since my first trip through the strait manned their canoes to put off for the sloop. It was not prudent to come to, the anchorage being within bowshot of the shore, which was thickly wooded, but I made signs that one canoe might come alongside while the sloop ranged about under sail in the lee of the land. The others I motioned to keep off, and incidentally laid a rifle in sight, close at hand, on top of the cabin. In the canoe that came alongside, crying their never-ending begging word, Yammer Schooner, were 2 squaws and 1 Indian, the hardest specimens of humanity I had ever seen in any of my travels. Yammer Schooner was their plaint when they pushed off from shore, and Yammer Schooner it was when they got alongside. The squaws beckoned for food, while the Indian, a black-visaged savage, stood sulkily as if he took no interest at all in the matter. But on my turning my back for some biscuits and jerked beef for the squaws, the buck sprang on deck and confronted me, saying in Spanish jargon that we had met before. I thought I had recognized the tone of his Yammer Schooner, and his full beard identified him as the Black Pedro, whom, it was true, I had met before. "Where are the rest of the crew?" he asked, as he looked uneasily around, expecting Hands, maybe, to come out of the forescuttle and deal him his just deserts for many murders. "About 3 weeks ago, when you passed up here, I saw 3 men on board. Where are the other 2? I answered him briefly that the same crew was still on board. "But I see you are doing all the work." And with a leer, he added, as he glanced at the mainsail, "Hombre valiente." I explained that I did all the work in the day while the rest of the crew slept, so that they'd be fresh to watch for Indians at night. I was interested in the subtle cunning of the savage, knowing him as I did, perhaps better than he was aware. Even had I not been advised before I sailed from Sandy Point, I should have measured him for a villain now. Moreover, one of the squaws, with that spark of kindliness which is somehow found in the breast of even the lowest savage, warned me by a sign to be on my guard, or Black Pedro would do me harm. There was no need of the warning, however, for I was on my guard from the first, and at that moment held a smart revolver in my hand, ready for instant service. "When you sailed through here before, you fired a shot at me. Muy malo." I affected not to understand and said, "You've lived at Sandy Point, have you not?" He answered frankly, "Yes," and appeared delighted to meet one who had come from the dear old place, stepping forward as if to embrace an old friend. I motioned him back, for I did not share his flattering humor. "And you know Captain Pedro Samblich?" "Yes," said the villain who had killed a kinsman of Samblich. "Yes, indeed. He is a great friend of mine." "I know it. Samblich had told me to shoot him on sight." Pointing to my rifle and the cabin, he wanted to know how many times it fired. "Cuántos?" When I explained to him that the gun kept right on shooting, his jaw fell and he spoke of getting away. I did not hinder him from going. I gave the squaws biscuits and beef, and one of them gave me several lumps of tallow in exchange, and I think it worth mentioning that she did not offer me the smallest pieces, but with some extra trouble handed me the largest of all the pieces in the canoe. No Christian could have done more. Before pushing off from the sloop, the cunning savage asked for matches and made as if to reach with the end of his spear the box I was about to give him, but I held it toward him on the muzzle of my rifle, the one that kept on shooting. The chap picked the box off the gun gingerly enough, to be sure, but he jumped when I said, "Look out!" At which the squaws laughed and seemed not at all displeased. Perhaps the wretch had clubbed them that morning for not gathering mussels enough for his breakfast. From Charles Island, the Spray crossed over to Fortescue Bay, where she anchored and spent a comfortable night under the lee of high land, while the wind howled outside. The bay was deserted now. They were Fortescue Indians, whom I had seen at the island, and I felt quite sure they could not follow the Spray in the present hard blow. Not to neglect a precaution, however, I sprinkled tacks on deck before I turned in. On the following day, the loneliness of the place was broken by the appearance of a great steamship, making for the anchorage with a lofty bearing. I threw out my flag and directly saw the stars and stripes flung to the breeze from the great ship. Under the cover of darkness that night, I went to the steamer, which I found to be the Columbia, from New York, bound for San Francisco. I carried all my guns with me in case it should be necessary to fight my way back. In the chief mate of the Columbia, Mr. Hannibal, I found an old friend, and he referred affectionately to days in Manila when we were there together, he in the Southern Cross and I in the Northern Light, both ships as beautiful as their names. Returning to the Spray, where I found all secure, I prepared for an early start in the morning. It was agreed that the steamer should blow a whistle for me if first on the move. I watched the steamer off and on through the night for the pleasure alone of seeing her electric lights, a pleasing sight in contrast to the ordinary Fuegian canoe with a brand of fire in it. The sloop was the first underway, but the Columbia, soon following, passed and saluted as she went by. Had the captain given me a steamer, his company would have been no worse off than they were 2 or 3 months later. I read afterward in a California paper, the Columbia, on her second trip to Panama, was wrecked on the rocks of the California coast. The Spray was then beating against wind and current, as usual, in the strait. At this point, the tides from the Atlantic and Pacific meet, and in the strait, as on the outside coast, their meeting makes a commotion of whirlpools and combers that in a gale of wind is dangerous to canoes and other frail craft. A few miles farther along was a large steamer ashore, bottom up. Passing this place, the sloop ran into a streak of light wind, and then, a most remarkable condition for straight weather, it fell entirely calm. Signal fires sprang up at once on all sides, and then more than 20 canoes hove in sight, all heading for the Spray. As they came within hail, their savage crews cried, "Amigo Yammer Schooner, bueno puerto aquí!" And like scraps of Spanish mixed with their own jargon, I had no thought of anchoring in their good port. I hoisted the sloop's flag and fired a gun, all of which they might construe as a friendly salute or an invitation to come on. They drew up in a semicircle, but kept outside of 80 yards, which in self-defense would have been the death line. In their mosquito fleet was a ship's boat stolen probably from a murdered crew. 6 savages paddled us rather awkwardly with the blades of oars which had been broken off. 2 of the savages standing erect wore sea boots, and this sustained the suspicion that they had fallen upon some luckless ship's crew, and also added a hint that they had already visited the Spray's deck and would now, if they could, try her again. Their sea boots, I have no doubt, would have protected their feet and rendered carpet tacks harmless. Paddling clumsily, they passed down the strait at a distance of 100 yards from the sloop in an offhand manner and as if bound to Fortescue Bay. This I judged to be a piece of strategy, and so kept a sharp lookout over a small island which soon came in range between them and the sloop, completely hiding them from view, and toward which the Spray was now drifting helplessly with the tide, and with every prospect of going on the rocks, for there was no anchorage, at least none that my cables could reach. And sure enough, I soon saw a movement in the grass just on top of the island. I fired several shots over the place, but saw no other sign of the savages. It was they that had moved the grass, for as the sloop swept past the island, the rebound of the tide carrying her clear, there on the other side was the boat, surely enough exposing their cunning and treachery. A stiff breeze coming up suddenly now scattered the canoes while it extricated the sloop from a dangerous position, albeit the wind, though friendly, was still ahead. The spray, flogging against current and wind, made Borgia Bay on the following afternoon, and cast anchor there for the second time. I would now, if I could, describe the moonlit scene on the strait at midnight. A heavy cloud bank that had swept across the sky then cleared away, and the night became suddenly as light as day, or nearly so. A high mountain was mirrored in the channel ahead, and the spray sailing along with her shadow was as two sloops on the sea. Early the next morning, I stood out from Borgia Bay, and that night I anchored in Langara Cove, a few miles farther along, where on the following day I discovered wreckage and goods washed up from the sea. I worked all day now, salving and boating off a cargo to the sloop. The bulk of the goods was tallow in casks and in lumps from which the casks had been broken away, and embedded in the seaweed was a barrel of wine, which I also towed alongside. I hoisted them all in with the halyards, which I took to the windlass. The weight of some of the casks was a little over 800 pounds. At this place I filled a barrel of water, and on the following day sailed with a fair wind at last. I had not sailed far, however, when I came abreast of more tallow in a small cove, where I anchored and boated off as before. It rained and snowed hard all that day, and it was no light work carrying tallow in my arms over the boulders on the beach. But I worked on till the spray was loaded with a full cargo. I was happy then in the prospect of doing a good business farther along on the voyage, for the habits of an old trader would come to the surface. I sailed from the cove about noon, greased from top to toe, while my vessel was tallowed from keelson to truck. My cabin, as well as the hold and deck, was stowed full of tallow, and all were thoroughly smeared. Another gale had then sprung up, but the wind was still fair, and I had only 26 miles to run for Port Angosto, a dreary enough place, where, however, I would find a safe harbor in which to refit and stow cargo. I carried on sail to make the harbor before dark, and she fairly flew along, all covered with snow, which fell thick and fast till she looked like a white winter bird. Between the storm bursts, I saw the headland of my port and was steering for it when a flaw of wind caught the mainsail by the lee, jibed it over, and how nearly was this the cause of disaster? For the sheet parted and the boom unshipped, and it was then close upon night. I worked till the perspiration poured from my body to get things adjusted and in working order before dark, and above all, to get it done before the sloop drove to leeward of the port of refuge. Even then, I did not get the boom shipped in its saddle. I was at the entrance of the harbor before I could get this done, and it was time to haul her to or lose the port. But in that condition, like a bird with a broken wing, she made the haven. The accident which so jeopardized my vessel and cargo came of a defective sheet rope, one made from sisal, a treacherous fiber which has caused a deal of strong language among sailors. I did not run the spray into the inner harbor of Port Angosto, but came to inside a bed of kelp under a steep bluff on the port hand going in. I remained at Port Angosto some days, busily employed about the sloop. I stowed the tallow from the deck to the hold, arranged my cabin in better order, and took in a good supply of wood and water. I also mended the sloop's sails and rigging. I never forgot, even at the busiest time of my work there, to have my rifle by me ready for instant use, for I was of necessity within range of savages, and I had seen Fuegian canoes at this place when I anchored in the port, farther down the reach, on the first trip through the strait. I think it was on the second day, while I was busily employed about the decks, that I heard the swish of something through the air close by my ear, and I heard a zip-like sound in the water, but I saw nothing. However, I suspected that it was an arrow of some sort, for just then one passing not far from me struck the mainmast, where it stuck fast, vibrating from the shock, a Fuegian autograph. The savage was somewhere near. There could be no doubt about that. He might be shooting at me, with a view to getting my sloop and her cargo. So I threw up my old rifle that kept on shooting, and the first shot uncovered three Fuegians, who scampered from a clump of bushes where they had been concealed and made over the hills. I fired away a good many cartridges, aiming under their feet to encourage their climbing. My dear old gun woke up the hills, and at every report all three of the savages jumped as if shot, but they kept on and put Fuego real estate between themselves and the spray as fast as their legs could carry them. As the days went by, the season became more favorable for a chance to clear the strait with a fair wind. And so I made up my mind, after 6 attempts, being driven back each time, to be in no further haste to sail. The bad weather on my last return to Port Angosto for shelter brought the Chilean gunboat Condor and the Argentine cruiser Azzo Pardo into port. As soon as the latter came to anchor, Captain Mascarella sent a boat to the Spray with the message that he would take me in tow for Sandy Point if I would give up my voyage and return, the farthest thing from my mind. On the 13th day of April, and for the 7th and last time, she weighed anchor from that port. Difficulties, however, multiplied all about in so strange a manner that had I been given to superstitious fears, I should not have persisted in sailing on a 13th day, notwithstanding that a fair wind blew in the offing. Many of the incidents were ludicrous. When I found myself, for instance, disentangling the sloop's mast from the branches of a tree after she'd drifted 3 times around a small island against my will, it seemed more than one's nerves could bear, and I had to speak about it, so I thought, or die of lockjaw. And I admonished the Spray as an impatient farmer might his horse or his ox. But the poor old Spray had essayed, and successfully, too, nearly everything else in the Strait of Magellan, and my heart softened toward her when I thought of what she'd gone through. Now at last, the Spray carried me free of Tierra del Fuego. The waves doffed their white caps beautifully to her in the strait that day before the southeast wind, the first true winter breeze of the season from that quarter. And here she was, out on the first of it, with every prospect of clearing Cape Pilar before it should shift. So it turned out. The wind blew hard, as it always blows about Cape Horn, but she'd cleared the great tide race off of Cape Pilar and the Evangelistas, the outermost rocks of all, before the change came. I remained at the helm, humoring my vessel in the cross seas, for it was rough, and I did not dare to let her take a straight course. It was necessary to change her course in the combing seas, to meet them with what skill I could when they rolled up ahead, and keep them off when they came up abeam. One wave in the evening, larger than others that had threatened all day, broke over the sloop fore and aft. It washed over me at the helm, the last that swept over the Spray off Cape Horn. It seemed to wash away old regrets. All my troubles were now astern. Summer was ahead. All the world was again before me. The wind was even literally fair. My trick at the wheel was now up, and it was 5 p.m. I'd stood at the helm since 11 o'clock the morning before, or 30 hours. Then was the time to uncover my head, for I sailed alone with God. The vast ocean was again around me, and the horizon was unbroken by land. A few days later, the Spray was under full sail. The wind was still southeast, but it had moderated, and roaring seas had turned to gossiping waves that rippled and pattered against her sides as she rolled among them, delighted with their story. Rapid changes went on those days, and things all about while she headed for the tropics. New species of birds came around. Albatrosses fell back and became scarcer and scarcer. Lighter gulls came in their stead and pecked for crumbs in the sloop's wake. On the 10th day from Cape Pilar, a shark came along, the first of its kind on this part of the voyage to get into trouble. I harpooned him and took out his ugly jaws. I had not till then felt inclined to take the life of any animal, but when John Shark hove in sight, my sympathy flew to the winds. From Cape Pilar, I steered for Juan Fernandez on the 26th of April, 15 days out, made that historic island right ahead. The blue hills of Juan Fernandez, high among the clouds, could be seen about 30 miles off. 1,000 emotions thrilled me when I saw the island, and I bowed my head to the deck. The wind being light through the day, the Spray did not reach the island till night. With what wind there was to fill her sails, she stood close in to shore on the northeast side, where it fell calm and remained so all night. I saw the twinkling of a small light farther along in a cove and fired a gun, but got no answer, and soon the light disappeared altogether. I heard the sea booming against the cliffs all night, and realized that the ocean swell was still great, although from the deck of my little ship it was apparently small. Soon after daylight, I saw a boat putting out toward me. As it pulled near, it so happened that I picked up my gun, which was on the deck, meaning only to put it below, but the people in the boat, seeing the piece in my hands, quickly turned and pulled back for shore, which was about 4 miles distant. There were 6 rowers in her, and I observed that they pulled with oars and oarlocks, after the manner of trained seamen, and so I knew they belonged to a civilized race. But their opinion of me must have been anything but flattering when they mistook my purpose with the gun and pulled away with all their might. I made them understand by signs, but not without difficulty, that I did not intend to shoot, that I was simply putting the piece in the cabin and that I wished them to return. When they understood my meaning, they came back and were soon on board. One of the party, whom the rest called King, spoke English. The others spoke Spanish. They'd all heard of the voyage of the Spray through the papers of Valparaiso and were hungry for news concerning it. They told me of a war between Chile and the Argentine, which I had not heard of when I was there. I had just visited both countries, and I told them that according to the latest reports, while I was in Chile, their own island was sunk. After some words of civility, the islanders took the Spray in tow of their boat and made toward the island with her at the rate of a good 3 knots. The King, I soon learned, was king only by courtesy. Having lived longer on the island than any other man in the world, 30 years, he was so dubbed. Juan Fernandez was then under the administration of a governor of Swedish nobility, so I was told. The governor at the time of my visit was away at Valparaiso with his family. The King had been away once for a year or two, and in Rio de Janeiro had married a Brazilian woman who followed his fortunes to the far-off island. He was himself a Portuguese and a native of the Azores. He had sailed in New Bedford whale ships and had steered a boat. All this I learned, and more too, before we reached the anchorage. The sea breeze, coming in before long, filled the Spray's sails, and the experienced Portuguese mariner piloted her to a safe berth in the bay, where she was moored to a buoy abreast the settlement. The Spray being secured, and with a view to business, I hooked my steelyards to the boom at once, ready to weigh out tallow. I did not charge a high price for what I sold, but the ancient and curious coins I got in payment, some of them from the wreck of a galleon sunk in the bay no one knows when, I sold afterwards to antiquarians for more than face value. In this way, I made a reasonable profit. I brought away money of all denominations from the island, and nearly all there was, so far as I could find out. Juan Fernandez, as a place of call, is a lovely spot. The hills are well wooded, the valleys fertile, and pouring down through many ravines or streams of pure water. There are no serpents on the island, and no wild beasts other than pigs or goats, of which I saw a number, with possibly a dog or two. The people lived without the use of rum or beer of any sort. There was not a police officer or a lawyer among them. Although there was no doctor, the people were all healthy, and the children were all beautiful. There were about 45 souls on the island, all told. The adults were mostly from the mainland of South America. One lady there from Chile, who made a flying jib for the Spray, taking her pay in tallow, would be called a belle in Newport. Blessed island of Juan Fernandez. Why Alexander Selkirk ever left you was more than I could make out. I, of course, made a pilgrimage to the old lookout place at the top of the mountain, where Selkirk spent many days peering into the distance for the ship which came at last. From a tablet fixed into the face of the rock, I copied these words, inscribed in Arabic capitals. In memory of Alexander Selkirk, mariner, a native of Largo, Scotland, who lived on this island in complete solitude for 4 years and 4 months. He was landed in 1704 and taken off in the Duke, privateer, February 1709. He died lieutenant of HMS Weymouth, 1723, at age 47. The cave in which Selkirk dwelt while on the island is at the head of the bay now called Robinson Crusoe Bay. I visited Robinson Crusoe Bay in a boat, and with some difficulty landed through the surf near the cave which I entered. I found it dry and inhabitable. It is located in a beautiful nook sheltered by high mountains from all the severe storms that sweep over the island, which are not many. On the morning of May 5th, 1896, I sailed from Juan Fernandez. From the island, the Spray bore away to the north, passing the island of St. Felix before she gained the trade winds, which seemed slow in reaching the limits. If the trades were tardy, however, when they did come, they came on with a bang and made up for lost time, and the Spray flew before a gale for a great many days toward the Marquesas in the west, which she made on the 43rd day out and still kept on sailing. My time was all taken up those days, not by standing at the helm. No man, I think, could stand or sit and steer a vessel round the world. I did better than that, for I sat and read my books, mended my clothes, or cooked my meals and ate them in peace. I had already found that it was not good to be alone, and so I made companionship with what there was around me, sometimes with the universe and sometimes with my own insignificant self, but my books were always my friends, let fail all else. Nothing could be easier or more restful than my voyage in the trade winds. For one whole month, my vessel held her course true, I woke sometimes to find the sun already shining into my cabin. I heard water rushing by with only a thin plank between me and the depths, and I said, "How's this?" But it was all right. It was my ship on her course, sailing as no ship had ever sailed before in the world. The rushing water along her side told me that she was sailing at full speed. I knew that no human hand was at the helm. I knew that all was well with the hands forward, and that there was no mutiny on board. Slowly but surely, the mark of my little ship's course on the chart reached out in the ocean and across it. On the 43rd day from land, a long time to be at sea alone, the sky being beautifully clear and the moon being in distance with the sun, I threw up my sextant for sights. I found from the result of 3 observations after long wrestling with lunar tables that her longitude by observation agreed within 5 miles of that by dead reckoning. Now, this was wonderful. Both, however, might be in error, but somehow I felt confident that both were nearly true, and that in a few hours more I should see land. And so it happened, for then I made the island of Nuka Hiva, the southernmost of the Marquesas group, clear-cut and lofty. The verified longitude, when abreast, was somewhere between the two reckonings. This was extraordinary. To be alone 43 days would seem a long time, but in reality, even here, winged moments flew lightly by. And instead of my hauling in for Nuka Hiva, which I could have made as well as not, I kept on for Samoa, where I wished to make my next landing. This occupied 29 days more, making 72 days in all. I was not distressed in any way during that time. There was no end of companionship. The very coral reefs kept me company, or gave me no time to feel lonely, which is the same thing, and there were many of them now in my course to Samoa. First among the incidents of the voyage from Juan Fernandez to Samoa was a narrow escape from collision with a great whale that was absent-mindedly plowing the ocean at night while I was below. The noise from his startled snort and the commotion he made in the sea as he turned to clear my vessel brought me on deck in time to catch a wetting from the water he threw up with his flukes. The monster was apparently frightened. He headed quickly for the east. I kept on going west. Hungry sharks came about the vessel often when she neared islands or coral reefs. I owned to a satisfaction in shooting them as one would a tiger. Sharks, after all, are the tigers of the sea. Nothing is more dreadful to the mind of a sailor, I think, than a possible encounter with a hungry shark. On the 16th of July, after considerable care and some skill and hard work, the spray cast anchor at Apia, in the Kingdom of Samoa, about noon. My vessel being moored, I spread an awning, and instead of going at once on shore, I sat under it till late in the evening, listening with delight to the musical voices of the Samoan men and women. Next morning, bright and early, Mrs. Robert Louis Stevenson came to the spray and invited me to Vailima the following day. I was, of course, thrilled when I found myself, after so many days of adventure, face to face with this bright woman, so lately the companion of the author who had delighted me on the voyage. The kindly eyes that looked me through and through sparkled when we compared notes of adventure. I marveled at some of her experiences and escapes. She told me that, along with her husband, she had voyaged in all manner of rickety craft among the islands of the Pacific, reflectively adding, "Our tastes were similar." As I sailed farther from the center of civilization, I heard less and less of what would and what would not pay. Mrs. Stevenson, in speaking of my voyage, did not once ask me what I would make out of it. When I came to a Samoan village, the chief did not ask the price of gin or say, "How much will you pay for roast pig?" but, "Dollar, dollar, white man know only dollar. Never mind dollar. The tapo is prepared ava. Let us drink and rejoice." The tapo is the virgin hostess of the village. In this instance, it was Toloa, daughter of the chief. "Our taro is good. Let us eat. On the tree there is fruit. Let the day go by. Why should we mourn over that? There are millions of days coming. The breadfruit is yellow in the sun, and from the cloth tree is Taloa's gown. Our house, which is good, costs but the labor of building it, and there is no lock on the door." While the days go thus in these southern islands, we at the north are struggling for the bare necessities of life. For food, the islanders have only to put out their hand and take what nature has provided for them. If they plant a banana tree, their only care afterward is to see that too many trees do not grow. They have great reason to love their country and to fear the white man's yoke, for once harnessed to the plow, their life would no longer be a poem. To the unconventional mind, the punctilious etiquette of Samoa is perhaps a little painful. For instance, I found that in the partaking of Ava, the social bowl, I was supposed to toss a little of the beverage over my shoulder, or pretend to do so, and say, "Let the gods drink," and then drink it all myself. And the dish, invariably a coconut shell, being empty, I might not pass it politely as we would do, but politely throw it twirling across the mats at the tapo. It was the fashion of the native visitors to the spray to come over the bows, where they could reach the headgear and climb aboard with ease, and on going ashore to jump off the stern and swim away. Nothing could have been more delightfully simple. The modest natives wore lava-lava bathing dresses, a native cloth from the bark of the mulberry tree, and they did no harm to the spray. In Summerland, Samoa, their coming and going was only a merry everyday scene. At Apia, I had the pleasure of meeting a Mr. A. Young, the father of the late Queen Margaret, who was Queen of Manua from 1891 to 1895. Her grandfather was an English sailor who married a princess. While hobnobbing, as it were, with royalty, I called on the king himself, the late Malietoa. King Malietoa was a great ruler. He never got less than $45 a month for the job, as he told me himself, and this amount had lately been raised, so that he could live on the fat of the land and not any longer be called Tin of Salmon Malietoa by graceless beachcombers. As my interpreter and I entered the front door of the palace, the king's brother, who was viceroy, sneaked in through a taro patch by the back way and sat cowering by the door while I told my story to the king. A gentleman in New York, interested in missionary work, had charged me when I sailed to give his remembrance to the king of the Cannibal Islands, other islands, of course, being meant. But the good King Malietoa, notwithstanding that his people have not eaten a missionary in 100 years, received the message himself, seemed greatly pleased to hear so directly from the publishers of the Missionary Review, and wished me to make his compliments in return. His Majesty then excused himself while I talked with his daughter, the beautiful Famu Sami, a name signifying to make the sea burn, and soon reappeared in the full-dress uniform of the German Commander-in-Chief, Emperor William himself, for, stupidly enough, I had not sent my credentials ahead that the king might be in full regalia to receive me. Calling to say goodbye to my friends at Vilima, I met Mrs. Stevenson to take Ava with the family and be ready for sea. This ceremony, important among Samoans, was conducted after the native fashion. A triton horn was sounded to let us know when the beverage was ready, and in response we all clapped hands. The bout being in honor of the spray, it was my turn first, after the custom of the country, to spill a little over my shoulder. But having forgotten the Samoan for "let the gods drink," I repeated the equivalent in Russian. Then I said, "Tofa," to my good friends of Samoa, and all wishing the spray bon voyage, she stood out of the harbor August 20th, 1896, and continued on her course. A sense of loneliness seized upon me as the islands faded astern, and as a remedy for it, I crowded on sail for lovely Australia, which was not a strange land to me. But for long days in my dreams, Vilima stood before the prow. The spray had barely cleared the islands when a sudden burst of the trades brought her down to close reefs, and she reeled off 184 miles the first day, of which I counted 40 miles of current in her favor. Finding a rough sea, I swung her off free and sailed north of the Horn Islands, also north of Fiji instead of south as I had intended, and coasted down the west side of the archipelago. Then I sailed direct for New South Wales, passing south of New Caledonia, and arrived at Newcastle after a passage of 42 days, mostly of storms and gales. I arrived at Newcastle in the teeth of a gale of wind. It was a stormy season. The government pilot met me at the harbor bar, and with the assistance of a steamer, carried my vessel to a safe berth. Nothing was too good for the spray here, and after I'd rested a few days, a port pilot with a tug carried her to sea again, and she made along the coast toward the harbor of Sydney, where she arrived on the following day, October 10, 1896. Summer was approaching, and the harbor of Sydney was blooming with yachts. Some of them came down to the weather-beaten spray and sailed around her at Shellcote, where she took a berth for a few days. At Sydney, I was once among friends. The spray remained at the various watering places in the great port for several weeks, and was visited by many agreeable people, frequently by officers of HMS Orlando and their friends. Captain Fisher, the commander, with a party of young ladies from the city and gentlemen belonging to his ship, came one day to pay me a visit in the midst of a deluge of rain. I never saw it rain harder, even in Australia. But they were out for fun, and rain could not dampen their feelings, however hard it poured. But as ill luck would have it, a young gentleman of another party on board, in the full uniform of a very great yacht club, with brass buttons enough to sink him, stepping quickly to get out of the wet, tumbled holus bolus head and heels into a barrel of water I'd been coopering, and being a short man, was soon out of sight and nearly drowned before he was rescued. It was the nearest to a casualty on the spray in her whole course, so far as I know. The young men, having come on board with compliments, made the mishap most embarrassing. It had been decided by his club that the spray could not be officially recognized, for the reason that she brought no letters from yacht clubs in America, and so I say it seemed all the more embarrassing and strange that I should have caught at least one of the members in a barrel, and, too, when I was not fishing for yachtsmen. Time flew fast those days in Australia, and it was December 6, 1896, when the spray sailed from Sydney. My intention was now to sail direct for Mauritius on my way home, and so I coasted along toward Bass Strait in that direction. There was little to report on this part of the voyage except changeable winds and rough seas. The 12th of December, however, was an exceptional day, with a fine coast wind northeast. The spray early in the morning passed Twofold Bay and later Cape Bunduro in a smooth sea with land close aboard. The lighthouse on the cape dipped a flag to the spray's flag, and children on the balconies of a cottage near the shore waved handkerchiefs as she passed by. I saw festoons of evergreen in token of Christmas near at hand. I saluted the merrymakers, wishing them a Merry Christmas, and could hear them say, "I wish you the same." With unusual luck of fine weather, the spray made Melbourne on the 22nd of December, and taken in tow by the steam tug Racer, was brought into port. Christmas Day was spent in a berth in the River Yarrow, but I lost little time in shifting to St. Kilda, where I spent nearly a month. January 24, 1897, found the spray again in tow of the tug Racer, leaving Hobson's Bay after a pleasant time in Melbourne and St. Kilda. In the summer months, that is, December, January, February, and sometimes March, east winds are prevalent through Bass Strait, but owing to a vast amount of ice drifting up from the Antarctic, this was all changed now and emphasized with much bad weather. I decided to spend time in Tasmania, waiting for the season for favorable winds through Torres Strait by way of the Great Barrier Reef. Well, I should mention that while I was at Melbourne, there occurred one of those extraordinary storms, sometimes called Rain of Blood, the first of the kind in many years about Australia. The blood came from a fine brick dust matter afloat in the air from the deserts. A rainstorm setting in brought down this dust simply as mud. Sailors no longer regard them with superstitious fear, but our credulous brothers on the land cry out, "Rain of blood!" at the first splash of the awful mud. It was only a few hours' sail to Tasmania across the strait, the wind being fair and blowing hard. The season of fair weather around the north of Australia being yet a long way off, I sailed to other ports in Tasmania, where it's fine the year round, the first of these being Beauty Point, near which are Beaconsfield and the Great Tasmania Gold Mine, which I visited in turn. I saw much gray, uninteresting rock being hoisted out of the mine there, and hundreds of stamps crushing it into powder. People told me there was gold in it, and I believed what they said. I remember Beauty Point for its shady forest and for the road among the tall gum trees. From this snug little place, I made sail for Devonport, a thriving place on the River Mersey, a few hours' sail westward along the coast, and fast becoming the most important port in Tasmania. Fish and game were plentiful here, and the voice of the gobbler was heard. I was haunted by the beauty of the landscape all about, of the natural ferneries then disappearing, and of the domed forest trees on the slopes. The spray was hauled out on the marine railway at Devonport and examined carefully top and bottom, but was found absolutely free from the destructive teredo and sound in all respects. To protect her further against the ravage of these insects, the bottom was coated once more with copper paint, for she would have to sail through the coral and Araphora seas before refitting again. Everything was done to fit her for all the known dangers. But it was not without regret that I looked forward to the day of sailing from a country of so many pleasant associations. If there was a moment in my voyage when I could have given it up, it was there and then. But no vacancies for a better post being open, I weighed anchor April 16, 1897, and again put to sea. Having a full set of Admiralty charts of the coast and Barrier Reef, I felt easy in mind. The wind, for a few days after passing Port Stephen, Seal Rocks, and Cape Hawke, was light and dead ahead. With a good stock of books on board, I fell to reading day and night, leaving this pleasant occupation merely to trim sails or tack, or to lie down and rest, while the spray nibbled at the miles. The spray rounded Great Sandy Cape and picked up the trade winds, and these winds followed her now for many thousands of miles, never ceasing to blow from a moderate gale to a mild summer breeze, except at rare intervals. The spray was now in a protected sea in smooth water, the first she had dipped her keel into since leaving Gibraltar, and a change it was from the heaving of the misnamed Pacific Ocean. The Pacific is perhaps, on the whole, no more boisterous than other oceans, though I feel quite safe in saying that it is not more Pacific except in name. It is often wild enough in one part or another. I once knew a writer who, after saying beautiful things about the sea, passed through a Pacific hurricane, and he became a changed man. But where, after all, would be the poetry of the sea were there no wild waves? At last here was the spray in the midst of a sea of coral. The sea itself might be called smooth indeed, but coral rocks are always rough, sharp, and dangerous. I trusted now to the mercies of the maker of all reefs, keeping a good lookout at the same time for perils on every hand. On the morning of the 26th, Gloucester Island was close aboard, and the spray anchored in the evening at Port Denison, where rests on a hill the sweet little town of Bowen, the future watering place and health resort of Queensland. The country all about here had a healthful appearance. From Port Denison, the sloop ran before the constant trade wind and made no stop at all, night or day, till she reached Cooktown on the Endeavour River, where she arrived Monday, May 31st, 1897, before a furious blast of wind encountered that day 50 miles down the coast. On this parallel of latitude is the high ridge and backbone of the trade winds, which about Cooktown amount often to a hard gale. With a fair wind, and in the clear weather of that season, the way through the Barrier Reef Channel, in all sincerity, was clearer than a highway in a busy city, and by all odds, less dangerous. But to anyone contemplating the voyage, I would say, beware of reefs day or night, or, remaining on the land, be wary still. Tacking inside of all the craft and port, I moored her at sunset nearly abreast the Captain Cook Monument, and next morning went ashore to feast my eyes on the very stones the great navigator had seen, for I was now on a seaman's consecrated ground. But there seemed a question in Cooktown's mind as to the exact spot where his ship, the Endeavour, hove down for repairs on her memorable voyage around the world. Some said it was not at all at the place where the monument now stood. A discussion of the subject was going on one morning where I happened to be, and a young lady present, turning to me as one of some authority in nautical matters, very flatteringly asked my opinion. Well, I could see no reason why Captain Cook, if he had made up his mind to repair his ship inland, couldn't have dredged out a channel to the place where the monument now stood, if he had a dredging machine with him, and afterward fill it up again. For Captain Cook could do most anything, and nobody ever said that he hadn't a dredger along. The young lady seemed to lean to my way of thinking, and following up the story of the historical voyage, asked if I had visited the point farther down the harbor where the great circumnavigator was murdered. This took my breath, but a bright schoolboy coming along relieved my embarrassment, for, like all boys, seeing that information was wanted, he volunteered to supply it. Said he, "Captain Cook wasn't murdered here at all, ma'am. He was killed in Africa. A lion ate him." The matter standing so, I sailed on June 6th, 1897, heading away for the north as before. I stood across for Thursday Island, now in plain view, mid-channel and Torres Strait, where I arrived shortly after noon. Here the spray remained over until June 24th. Being the only American representative at port, this tarry was imperative, for on the 22nd was the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, The 2 days over were, as sailors say, for coming up. I spent pleasant days about Thursday Island. Mr. Douglas, resident magistrate, invited me on a cruise in a steamer one day among the islands in Torres Strait. This being a scientific expedition in charge of Professor Mason Bailey, botanist, we rambled over Friday and Saturday Islands, where I got a glimpse of botany. Miss Bailey, the professor's daughter, accompanied the expedition and told me of many indigenous plants with long names.